Blog Talk Radio.
It's Movie Geeks United. It's going to be a great show tonight. Jerry, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing all right. Yeah, it is going to be a great show. We have Thomas Jane.
Yes. You
know, one of the many guys who played the Punisher, but more importantly, he was on Hung. But he also he's on the show for a very important reason, for the 3D Film Festival.
Exactly. And this is, it's in Los Angeles. It takes place, tonight's live airing of the show is taking place on the 29th. So for us right now, doing it live, it starts tomorrow, September 30th. It runs all weekend to the 3rd of October in Los Angeles. It's a wonderful event. And it's not only they have films, they have a great slate of films, including, which we talked to Thomas Jane about, they've converted – this is going to be fun. They've converted Ed Wood's Plan 9 from Outer Space into 3D. And you can imagine that if Ed Wood were alive today, he would probably be really delighted about that.
I think he would be.
Yeah. And they got a great series of films that are showing. But not only that, they have 3D interactive gaming, 3D short films, 3D commercials. I mean, this is everything 3D this weekend. And they also have a party that they're doing at an area nightclub, and Thomas is going to tell us all about that during the interview as well, where it's a completely 3D environment. So you walk into this nightclub, and it's a complete 3D experience.
Wow.
I know. I mean, this is the 3D heaven this weekend.
Speaking of
3D, I guess we can mention this real quickly. We'll talk about it in more detail later. But there's big news on the 3D front this week.
Oh, God, you're going to talk about it.
Yeah.
I knew it.
I'll just mention it. It'll be a teaser for the news we'll talk about a little bit later. Lucas announced he's releasing all six films, Star Wars films, in 3D in chronological order. So starting with Phantom Menace, ending with Jedi. And it'll be like the last reissues, in that you'll have one a year, but it was one every season last.
Yeah, it was one every season. But
okay. Well, so this isn't at all like the last issues. Forget what
I just
said.
Wait, couldn't he do it like the way he originally did it? Start with 4, 5, and 6. I mean, I might be dead by the time we get to the good ones. I mean, oh my God.
You said it. I didn't.
I that's right. But let me say, I love. I mean, probably more so than anyone on this show, in my parents' basement. And everything is testament to this. We have all this Star Wars stuff we never got rid of, but God, couldn't
well,
we start
good.
With
that's
episode?
Good stuff, man.
That's awesome.
You're smart.
Couldn't we start
smart
with episode 4, though?
I know, but I guess maybe the thinking is that it might be easier to do the conversion or more time efficient to do the conversion with a newer digital. I'm not sure. I'm just guesstimating.
I hope so. You know, this is what everyone's been talking about. He's been talking about this ever since Revenge of the Sith came out. He's been saying, I want to make these, you know, convert all of them into 3D. So,
right.
You know, this is, you know, whether we like it or not, this is really what his legacy will be, these six films. I guess we don't get American Graffiti in 3D, do we?
No.
Okay.
No.
Right.
I don't know how that movie would benefit from 3D. But you never know. But, you know, the point is, 3D is here to stay. We live in a 3D world, and
right.
And this festival is a testament to that. And Thomas Jane, besides, you know, we all know his work, and
right.
You and I both watch Hung, and millions of people do.
Mm-hmm.
and his work in movies like The Thin Red Line and Under Suspicion and The Punisher, and
right.
You know, we talk about most of those films. He has hosting duties at the 3D Film Festival in Los Angeles this weekend, and they're premiering his film as well that he directed. It's called Dark Country, and he shot it in 3D. So,
wow.
I believe it premieres Saturday night. He'll expand upon that in our conversation. But let's get right to it. Thomas Jane, here he is. I hope you guys enjoy it. This is exciting. You're hosting the 3D Film Festival in Los Angeles. It's September 30th through October 3rd. And I'm curious to know what excited you about the prospect of hosting this festival when they approached you with the idea.
Well, I'm a 3D enthusiast. You know, I directed my first film in 3D called Dark Country. We're showing on Saturday night with a little Q&A.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been involved with 3D for a number of years. I'm a member of the Southern California Stereo Club. Been around for about 50 years. And they have chapters all over the world, stereo clubs. And
yeah.
We've been meeting, you know, with those guys and watching 3D and, you know, learning about 3D for a long time. So there's some people who kind of get 3D in a visceral way, and, you know, and some people are not as impressed by it. But I think that interocular illusion of watching a 3D image creates almost like a high in your mind for some people. In other words, people really get off on 3D.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm one of those people. I find it endlessly fascinating.
Well, in decades,
asked me to be a host of the 3D Film Festival, I think a very natural fit for me.
Well, in decades past, when 3D movies have kind of come and gone, I guess they came and went because they were seen as more of a gimmick. What do you think is different about this age of 3D filmmaking?
Well, 3D was taken very seriously came out in the 50s. 3D has been around since the late 1800s. But started making movies in 3D in a popular level. You know, it was very popular. It was around for a few years. They made hundreds of 3D films.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are very, very good. What killed 3D in the 50s was the fact that the basically user error. Projectors, they had, projectionists had trouble lining up the two projectors and keeping them in sync. You know, the fact that you're using a very analog system with a lot of room for error, and the audiences got kind of tired of going to the theater and knowing that, you know, there's as good a chance as there was not that something was going to be wrong with the 3D in the theater. But this time around, with 3D going digital, there's no room for user error, and every screening looks just like the last.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to see 3D stick around, because people always get the same experience now when they're watching a 3D film.
And you as you mentioned, your film that you directed is showing there, and I want to talk to you about your film. But first, some of the other events that are taking place there. They've converted the Ed Wood film, Plan 9 from Outer Space. That's one of the films I know. What are some other great showcases?
Well, I think they're going to show Piranha 3D. There'll be some terrific 3D film programming. There's also Flash has a video that they're going to premiere at the 3D Film Fest. There's video games. There's auto stereoscopic screens. You know, all the cutting edge sort of 3D technology that you're going to see roll out over the next couple of years will make an appearance at 3D Film Fest. So it's sort of all things 3D. Are going to be represented there. And, of course, there'll be a lot of people there answering questions about the future of 3D and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the 3D movies are what's going to be cool.
Yeah.
Besides Plan 9 from Outer Space, I'm hoping that we're going to screen a couple of the old 3D films from the 50s. People can get a chance to check some of that out, too.
And there's not only movies. There are showcases there for 3D games and short films and interactive media. And I mean, it's a whole entire 3D experience.
That's right. That's what I said.
You're never going to take your glasses off the whole weekend.
You know, yeah, there's really cool glasses that are now permanent. When you walk outside the theater, they polarize into sunglasses.
Huh.
So it's very, very cool. Yeah, way of, and I've, you know, we'll be giving those away. You can also buy them there. You know, everybody needs their own permanent pair of 3D glasses, and there are also sunglasses. 3D
yeah,
sunglasses.
I think so too. But not only that, they're giving away tickets to the events and the screenings through Facebook and Twitter. Is that correct?
Yeah. Go to 3dff.org, and there'll be a link to Facebook and Twitter. If you friend the festival, then you get free tickets to go to the show. So highly recommended that you guys go on Facebook, 3dff.org. And friend or Twitter, and you'll get yourself some free tickets.
And your hosting duties, what do those entail? When will people be able to see you at the event?
Well, I'll definitely be there for my screening on Saturday night. We're screening my film at 10 o'clock. I'm going to introduce the film and then do a Q&A after. And then definitely be around for the last day, Sunday. I think we're showing Legend of the Guardians in 3D Sunday afternoon for the kids program. I'm definitely going to go to that because I want to see that in 3D.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll be around, hanging around there, and we'll do the closing ceremony stuff. We're also throwing a 3D nightclub on Saturday night at the Avalon. It's something that they've done in the past and had great success with it. You know, you can imagine everybody wandering around the nightclub with their 3D glasses on. Cool, you know. We have all these projections in 3D against the walls, and it was a big hit. I did it last year, so I'll bring that back on Saturday night. I'll be there. You know, if you come around your 3D film festival, you hang around. Chances are more likely than not that you'll catch a glimpse of me.
Now, Dark Country, your film, how did that material lend itself to 3D?
I'm interested in 3D for its storytelling capacity, how to enhance a story by telling it in 3D, not just using it as a gimmick, but actually using 3D to tell the story. So in Dark Country is psychological thriller, I wanted to use the 3D to enhance the visceral feeling of being inside a killer's mind and experiencing the world through the killer's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the premise that I based shooting a film in 3D on. And I think it was successful in a lot of ways. And I think there's, you know, further to go in building the language of 3D and using it in an integral part of the storytelling, much the way that, you know, today we use sound. Sound is not just a gimmick or a fun thing, but it's an integral way to the way we experience a film. So is color, so is stereo, surround sound, and now 3D. We want to use 3D to enhance the movie-going experience and to enhance what you take away from particular film.
Driving across the desert tonight. Take care of that new wife of yours.
Ready?
Mm-hmm.
One last look?
No, thanks. You think we're crazy? Feel that?
I can oven outside so hot.
All the same, I'm
touching
with the light.
car.
I need your help.
Get the door.
What are we gonna do?
Now. The honey boy.
Gabby, help me.
Is over. Thomas Jane. Lauren German. And Ron Perlman.
So you actually shot this in 3D. How is the process of actually shooting a film in that format? Is it a little more arduous a process than regular film?
There's so many different aspects that goes into movie making. Each film is unique. You know, you might be shooting in the rain for one film. You know, most of one film might take place on the ocean. All these things add to the physical production of making a film. So when you say, oh, we're going to shoot in 3D, it's just another layer of stuff that you're going to throw on the film. No, we're not shooting in the rain. We're not shooting in the fog. We're not shooting on the water. We're shooting in 3D. And then if we shot 3D on the water, then that would be that set of parameters, you know. With film, the movie itself dictates how many different parameters you're going to have to deal with. And with this one, it's 3D, so it shouldn't, and it didn't. We shot the film in 24 days. People say 3D slows you down. It does not. It doesn't have to, put it that way. We shot the film. Dark Country is the very first live-action 3D film to be shot purely digital. So we cut a lot of ground. We broke a lot of ground with my film. You know, I had a couple of Mac laptops nailed to a piece of plywood. That's how and they were tethered to the cameras that we were using. That's how we shot the movie. You know, today you don't have all these cables, the proper monitors, and a whole other better way of shooting 3D today. But part of my thesis was I wanted to be able to make a film in 3D and not spend any more time on it than I would in 2D. And I accomplished that. We shot the movie, like I said, in 24 days. So there's a lot to learn, you know, in the process. And I like being on the cutting edge of what you can do with a particular set of parameters.
Well, in talking about 3D over the past couple of years on the show, and we've talked to James Cameron about it and a few other filmmakers about it, but Cameron's point is he thinks that 3D will just become kind of a norm, like you mentioned, like color became the norm, sound, right. You know, all the technological innovations over the history of film. Do you feel the same way?
I love it. 3D, of course. Of course. Why would we assume that we've stopped evolving?
Mm-hmm.
Right? When black and white film came in, that was a great, great achievement. And they added sound. That was a great achievement. They added stereo sound and color. Those were great achievements. Why would we stop there?
Right.
Why would, as a society, would we suddenly say, well, that's it. We're all done evolving film. Of course not. No, we're going to have 3D film. That'll become the norm. And then we'll have holograms. That'll become the norm. God knows where we'll take it from there. I guarantee you it'll continue to evolve. Get used to it.
Yeah. Do you mind?
The ever-changing kaleidoscope. Beautiful idea.
Do you mind if I ask you just a couple of questions about some previous projects that you've been involved in?
Sure. I might lose you because we're driving up into the hills, but go ahead.
Okay. Because this is Dark Country is your first feature film directorial debut, if I'm not mistaken. And you've worked with some terrific directors over the years, and I wanted to ask you about just a couple of them and see what you learned from them or you observed of them, starting with Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, great filmmaker. You know, very bright, bright guy, and meticulous in his sort of orientation of the detail, and you know, a great way with actors, very very unique way of dealing with actors that that pays off. You know, it shows that the performances not only are great individually, but they congeal together in a unique way.
Mm-hmm.
That is a result of his sensibility, the way he describes the scene.
Thanks, Bill.
To the individual actor, and gets everybody sort of playing as an ensemble, you know. He's a great way of bringing together a cast and making them feel like a united family.
Yeah.
That is working either for or against a particular goal or ideal. And I think directing is all about communicating. It's all about describing reality that you see or want to create. Your ability to describe that reality to other people is determines what kind of director you are. All the directors that I've worked with that are great at what they do are excellent at describing reality. Describe. Describe too much.
Well, you
can't over-describe something.
You work with another director that's kind of, for movie fans, that's kind of wrapped in mystery, and that's Terrence Malick.
Yep.
What was his directorial approach?
Terry has a very free-flowing directorial approach. He was extremely fluid,
mm-hmm,
with the camera and also his actors. He's someone who's seeking the truth over form or even substance. The truth of a moment, truth of what an actor's behavior is, or what you're looking at, is much more interesting to Terry than anything else. I was shooting a scene with Terry Malick, and halfway through the scene, him and John Toll, the DP, just got up and left with the camera, and they left me sitting there, and then they came back in about 45 minutes. They said, "Hey, where the hell did you guys go?" And Terry said, "Oh, we saw a butterfly. Butterfly was just the most beautiful thing, and I had to go film it. Anyway, where were we?" And so that's Terry Malick. Incredible.
Wow. And I have to.
Beautiful film.
It is a beautiful film. All of his films are transcendent. I mean, they're breathtaking. This is one movie I have to ask you about before I let you go, because in this film, it's a really good movie, and you stood toe-to-toe with two of the great actors we've ever had, and that's Gene Hackman and Morgan Freeman in Under Suspicion.
Oh, yeah.
What was that experience like? Give me a taste of that.
That was an interesting, for me, because it was kind of like a samurai class in acting.
Mm-hmm.
We had two extremely different approaches, and I learned a tremendous amount from both. Probably the film that I learned the most on was working with Hackman and and Freeman. Hackman is an incredibly meticulous actor who every detail of his character is worked out. And when I was doing my scenes with Hackman, you know, and I trying to be interesting, I'd pick up a paperweight on the table and start playing with it. And he'd say, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm just doing a little bit of business. He goes, why? Why are you doing it? Don't do anything unless you have a reason to do it, a real reason. Don't do anything. It kind of inhibited me for a little while, but I learned from it, you know. And Morgan Freeman, a much more fluid approach, more organic. You know, he would take naps in between setups. he had a much more sort of intuitive, fluid way of dealing with his character. I learned from that. Well, and I like to think that my own personal approach is a combination of the two.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're both equally as valuable approaches to acting. But these are two guys who have mastered their unique approaches to acting, and I never learned more, what we said. Every day was like a master samurai class in acting.
Yeah.
Great.
It feels like that watching it. As for me as a fan of acting and a fan of film, I mean it and yeah. It's so kind of contained in that room for the majority of the piece, and it's just acting bliss, that movie for me. I wanted to mention Hung. That's been picked up for another season, correct?
Yep, we're on for season 3.
I'm in the oldest profession in the world. Well, I'm about to be. Hey, it's been a rough couple of years.
In high school, you were a king.
What am I now?
Now you're just hung! Dad, wake up, Dad!
What?
You got insurance, right?
I am still your mother, and I'm not going to give up on it.
Your mom is trying, guys. You know, she wants to be a part of your lives.
Just fix the house, okay?
Desperate times call for desperate measures.
Repeat after me. I'm going to be a millionaire.
So, you want to get some coffee?
What is your winning tool?
I've got a big dick, Floyd.
So big, oh my God!
I'm a highly respected educator. I don't think you know who I am.
If you want, I can help.
You
want
to be my pimp?
Yeah.
What proof do I have that you're a good pimp, Tanya?
I have an in. She is the linchpin of our strategy. These clients of yours, whatever you want them to buy. My ladies are so loaded, they're recession-proof.
Ray, I put a lot of effort into being your pimp. Are you ready to be part of my winning team?
You shouldn't be lowering your price in this economy. You should be raising it.
I had lunch with Ray, and he decided that happiness consultants should be run by the three of us.
Ray is my prostitute! Share Ray or no Ray!
You need a professional, a sex therapist.
A professional professional.
You'd be surprised at what you could do to avoid another divorce.
Welcome to the majors, Ray.
Well, I love that show. I love that show. When you're invested in a character like that for that long a period of time, do you have any input on where you might want your character to go?
Yeah, a little bit, you know, here and there. But for the most part, you know, the relationship I have, the writers, Dream Colette, is very sort of organic. You know, in a lot of ways, they think I am Ray Drecker. And in a strange way, a lot of what we do sort of mirrors my own life. So I stay out of the results business, and I don't tend to tell them where or what I want to do with my character, because I trust that they already know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's kind of rare. I'm sure with other writers, writers. I'd be, you know, writing them long 10-page notes every episode. But not these guys. These guys have a very intuitive understanding my character.
Yeah.
And I like to be surprised.
There is great writing on that show.
Surprise me.
And you're terrific in the show, and you're right, the writing is impeccable on that program. So the 3D Film Festival, September 30th through October 3rd, your film Dark Country is part of the lineup, and it plays 10 o'clock on Saturday. That would be October 2nd?
You got it. I'll be there. Q&A, and expect to see all 3D enthusiasts and come on down and have some fun, because it's going to be a lot of fun.
Okay, that is Thomas Jane, a great actor and the host of the upcoming 3D Film Festival. It takes place at Los Angeles Film School, I believe, this year, in Los Angeles, obviously, September 30th through October 3rd. And this is very important. You can get tickets to free screenings by becoming a fan of their page on Facebook,
mm-hmm,
or following them on Twitter. And you can find out more about the festival at 3dff.org.
All right.
Does my phone make me sound like a computer?
No, it doesn't. No, not at
okay.
all. No,
I'm worried
by
about
way, that
I'm
was a really good interview.
Thank you.
It was really good. I really enjoyed
I'm worried about my connection and seeing all these flashing lights. And normally I sound like Mr. Roboto or something. Or...
No, you don't. No. I don't know who's telling you that.
I had somebody on the phone, and they said, you sound like Katy Perry in that one song that she does. Like,
that's not bad. If you sound like Katy Perry, that's not bad. I mean,
yeah.
It can only help us. I mean,
if I look like her, I'd never leave the house. Hey, Chris.
Hey, what's up? Yeah, it's not your phone. It's your personality that makes you sound like a computer.
Oh, man, that's harsh. Well, this is good. I like this. I like when it's the three of us. So.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. You know I love you, buddy.
I love you too, man. Okay, now that the homoerotic is out of the way. The big news stories this week in film, sadly, have to do with death.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday it was reported that Tarantino's longtime editor, Sally Menke, died. It is believed of heat exhaustion because she was hiking or walking at the time.
In the hottest day of the year in Los Angeles. I mean, in a long time,
yeah.
Too.
Well, the hottest day on record.
Yeah, I mean, it was just... And people had seen her before, and they'd asked her if she needed help, and she said no, and she seemed at that point very disoriented, and
well, I think
understandably
she, I think
so.
She, yeah, she was, like, walking with a friend, and
mm-hmm.
It was too hot for the friend, so the friend turned back, and she said,
right.
I'm going to go on. She's walking with her dog, I guess. So that's the belief right now, that she
mm-hmm.
just kind of got disoriented. She passed out, and she passed on. And then today it was reported that last night, director Arthur Penn passed of a heart failure, I believe. He was 88 years old.
Right.
So, I mean, this is, starting with Sally, this is a major loss, particularly for Tarantino.
It is
Tarantino
a
fans.
Huge loss for Tarantino. If you've ever, I don't know if you gentlemen have seen the Cutting Edge documentary about the editors. That came out a couple years ago,
yeah.
And she's featured prominently in that. And what you realize watching that, and the three of us know how important this really, everything happens in the editing suite, but with her, definitely. I mean, Tarantino says he might not have been able to make the film the vision that he wanted had it not been for her. I mean, he was a vital part of each film.
Editing is... so key in some of
yeah.
those movies of his
mm-hmm.
movies in particular. And it's weird how directors will often have a relationship with a screenwriter or a cinematographer that'll last a couple movies and then they'll sort of move on. But very often, not always, but often, directors will sort of stick with an editor for an
mm-hmm.
entire career. in the case of Spielberg, Scorsese, and then Tarantino, ironically a female in all three of those cases. But that's really, really, I can't imagine how that will affect his work. I mean, obviously it has implications that are more important than the future films of Tarantino. Very upsetting that someone lost their life and everything. But in terms of the film community, it's a huge loss. She was obviously very, very talented.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Tarantino had, terrific, tremendous reverence for her and her contribution of his success. Yeah, she was there from Reservoir Dogs on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he seems like the kind of guy who would be cutting his own movies, although I assume he just, it's a skill. He must not know much about it. You know, Tarantino strikes me as the kind of guy, it's not just the way he strikes me, it's the truth. He's just completely... Like, he owns every aspect of the film, so for him to be comfortable enough letting his baby in someone else's hands, literally someone's cutting hands, is really interesting. So she must have been tremendously important in his career.
And they were, from everything that I've gathered, they were very, very, very close.
Mm-hmm, they were.
He had a roast scheduled. They were going to roast him at the Friars Club Friday night, and he met with them Tuesday after he heard the news and obviously postponed it.
Right.
That's probably a good thing.
Yeah. I'm sure he's torn up about it.
Although, Geraldo wouldn't have been making any jokes at his expense, I can promise you that.
I know people would say, I mean, for me, Geraldo is a big deal just because I sort of, like, really clung to him and everyone on the Tough Crowd show with Colin Quinn. And that caught me out of, left field last week with the OD, and he was in the hospital. And then I just saw actually a couple hours ago he died, and it was just like, wow.
Yeah.
44 years old. I mean.
Yeah. I got really excited. I thought it was Geraldo at first, but turned out.
And I think Chris, you posted something a couple months ago on your Facebook page that was so bidding about Dennis Leary and Bill Hicks. I posted the clip. There's a famous thing from Tough Crowd where Geraldo goes, toe-to-toe with Dennis Leary. And, Dennis Leary, basically thinks thinks he's the top dog. And Geraldo is just like, well, if you, wrote more, cared more about your comedy, maybe your show would have lasted longer.
Yeah,
kind of thing. So he always had these zingers in him for young, the young Turk and everything. He had some great zingers, in him.
Yeah, I think that line that you're referring to, the reason nobody knows who Bill Hicks is and everyone knows who Dennis Leary is because there's no cure for cancer.
Yeah, that was brilliant when you wrote that.
That might actually have been Greg Giraldo's lines, not mine. I read it somewhere.
Okay, but it's still just so true.
So Arthur Penn.
Arthur Penn's crazy because Arthur Penn's been making. It's weird to think that he just died, and I'm not. I don't mean to laugh at it because I love his movies. But the fucking guy's been making movies since like the Eisenhower administration.
it's true.
Really
bizarre. He kind of shepherded Warren Beatty's career certainly with Mickey One, and then of course Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah.
So his major acclaim came from obviously Bonnie and Clyde, and second to that would probably be what do you think, Little Big Man?
He did Fame. Didn't he do Fame? Arthur Penn.
Did he direct what?
Fame.
I'm gonna go.
Fame is Alan Parker.
Sorry. Mm. Well, yeah, I guess Little Big Man would be the next big one, although there's other gems in there, too, like Night Moves, of course.
Night Moves is a real... The Missouri Breaks.
Yeah. That's another one. The Chase.
Alice's Restaurant.
I don't know. We'll have to agree to disagree on that one, but...
Target. I mean, obviously... obviously
Target.
Bonnie and Clyde, and we had a great a couple of years ago when they made the special edition DVD. We had a great show about that movie. Bonnie and Clyde and The Chase. I did not realize this. He was fired from the train. Wow.
Hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, I know that he's most famous for Bonnie and Clyde, but Little Big Man will always be my personal favorite of his
mm-hmm.
movies.
Yeah, and Inside Moves is just enhanced in popularity and status over the years.
Yeah, Night Moves, yeah. Night Moves.
I'm sorry.
I didn't see that till a couple years ago, and I was really blown away by that movie. That's a great film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Bonnie and Clyde really broke the mold, and
mm-hmm.
people always talk about Easy Rider, but, I mean, Bonnie and Clyde was the movie, I think,
mm-hmm.
that really jump-started that movement, even more so than Easy Rider.
Yeah.
And you had people that were critics that panned that movie because it was so new for American cinema, and they weren't quite certain whether or not to be offended by it, and you know, and then they went back after reading something like Pauline Kael's review of it,
mm-hmm.
and the commotion this movie caused, and they had a complete reassessment of it. You had very esteemed critics work a complete 180 on their opinion of this
right.
film within a couple of months' time.
Yeah. Yeah, which happens from time to time. Yeah, that happens from time to time with movies, and it's not completely disingenuous. Sometimes a movie can be so jarring that it takes you a little
yeah.
while to sort of adjust to it, and I think
mm-hmm.
that was probably the case with Bonnie and Clyde, genuinely, for a lot of critics. Like, I mean, it really was so much grittier and so much more real. The whole style of filmmaking was, you know, it probably felt, you know, like a fucking shock to them to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
But the way I can only compare it maybe to stylistically the way we felt when we first saw something like The Blair Witch Project, which
mm-hmm.
is like, oh, no, it's shot in this completely different way, and it's not like anything you've ever seen before. That's probably what it felt like to people at the time that it came out. So, you know, I understand that. I understand people, like, having to revisit it and sort of rethink it. I'm sure they did.
And, you know, and shocking material. I mean, just the fact that the lead character, I mean, just that he's impotent,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
Just that fact, to make a movie where that's even kind of spoken about. And to the oral sex in it
mm-hmm.
that
yeah.
is kind of hinted at. The graphic violence. And obviously the closing is what makes that movie so legendary.
Right.
The ending's massacre. But also the lingering pain, like when Gene Hackman is shot in the head and you're with him for an eternity and he's just writhing in pain after that wound, you know.
Yeah.
And it's obviously influenced by the European kind of sensibilities. The first
mm-hmm.
director that they approached for it was Truffaut, if I'm not mistaken.
I think
yeah,
right.
they were
I remember us talking about that, yeah.
Yeah.
Beatty was really obsessed with the whole French New Wave there with the making of that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that does not surprise me at all.
So what else is new?
Well, only first, because Chris hasn't been on for a while. Chris, have you seen anything recently that you want to talk about?
No, I haven't been to the theater. I'm sort of waiting probably for this weekend. There's some stuff out there that I'm mildly interested in, and I will see, but I have not seen it yet. It's sort of par for the course as far as this time of year goes
right.
every year.
Right.
But, yeah, this weekend will be a big weekend for movie
mm-hmm.
watching. I mean, I've been watching a lot of movies at home, you know, stuff that I don't tell you what I did watch. Clint Eastwood's The Changeling.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to, like, take up too much time on the show talking about a two-year-old movie, but
that's okay.
God damn, was that movie underrated. Like, that movie was really good. You know, I mean, from the performances right on down, I thought it was brilliant.
I thought the second half, when things really get going, they kick into gear. I mean, talking about you're on the edge of your seat. Her performance is good, but you know this performance, I'm really liking it because it's kind of, for him at least, it's not the usual part. Is Malkovich is very good.
Yeah. Yeah, Malkovich is fantastic. Great casting in the movie. So, yeah, that's what I've been doing lately, is watching a lot of movies on cable. Watch The Kid Stays in the Picture today, you know, and whatever
mm-hmm.
comes on, you know, I'll I'll listen to Bob Evans talk for 2 hours, no problem.
Can't go wrong there.
As far as movie news, what's going on in the movie? They're re-releasing the Star Wars movies in 3D, right? That was big news yesterday. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. Will this make money? Like, will that make money? Nothing
yes.
in the Star Wars. Yeah, maybe it will. Like, but I don't. Every other Star Wars attempt in the last couple of years seems like it's just like just empty, like empty heaves. You know, like there's nothing left to return from this. Maybe a 3D version if it's done well enough. Of the original, it is only the original three.
Talking about it for like 5 years, though, and he talks about everything. You know, he'll go back. You know, but it is gets to a point. It's not. Look, I love the original trilogy. I won't lie to you. I think the original trilogy is great. And I think once you watch the new ones, after a couple of viewings, where you finally live in denial, like I was, but you realize that wow, maybe these should not have been touched. Maybe these should not have been made. Just upsets. All right, we knew he was going to go back and do the original trilogy in 3D. Is it necessary to go back and do all of them in 3D?
Is that the plan? I thought it was just the original three.
No, it's starting.
No, it's
with
all
Phantom
it's
Menace.
All six. Yeah, and
holy
the first
shit,
one they're releasing is Phantom Menace.
Yeah, so
you got to be kidding me.
Yeah,
wow.
That's where the disappointment comes in. I think really.
Yeah, I think that will be a big disappointment then, if that's the case. They're releasing them in chronological order then? In sequential order, not in the order of, that they were made?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow, that seems like, I don't know, that seems like a big bet they're making there. Because, you know, you sort of want the momentum to start with the first release, and then...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
And it's not
with
the Phantom Menace.
I don't know that the first three releases in 3D will get that much money, and it's got to be pretty expensive to go back and retrofit those things for 3D, I would think.
That's one of the reasons why they're spreading it out one a year, because if they don't make money, the illusion is, from what I read in Hollywood Reporter, is that they're not going to continue to convert.
Maybe that's why he wants to start, maybe so he doesn't have to do the others. He figures, all right, the Phantom Menace, that's the most hated of the bunch there. No, but I can see what I've always said about the Phantom Menace is it's like he didn't have a story. He had the pod race, and he goes, I have to figure out a way to build something around this. So I guess the pod race would look great in 3D if you're really in. I mean, I just
well, I'm sure from an aesthetic point of view, the new movies will look great in 3D.
Yeah, the pod race.
The aesthetics weren't the problem.
Yeah, it was the pacing in the first one, especially the pacing is just god awful.
Although I would argue that partially the aesthetics were the problem, to a smaller degree than what you're talking about. What you're talking about, the pacing and the story was definitely a problem.
Oh yeah,
I do feel like it was just at the height of people's sort of disgust for too much CGI.
Mm-hmm.
And it just came at the wrong time, and it was done in the wrong way. I mean, Cameron proved that you can make a movie that's entirely CGI and people fall in love with it, and I don't think that anyone had done it before Cameron.
Sure.
I mean, I don't think anyone's done it since, and I don't know that they will, and I don't know that 3D is going to change that. I don't know that 3D is what those movies were missing, you know what I mean? I don't think it is.
Right. Well, yeah, without a doubt.
Now, let me ask you guys
if 3D is what was missing, he would have waited until 3D got to a point where... It was doable.
Yeah. Do you think Peter Jackson is going to go back and do The Lord of the Rings in 3D? Or is that already announced? Did I miss that? Or
it hasn't been announced, but I guarantee it's on the horizon.
Okay.
God damn. So creatively bankrupt. Can you imagine, just imagine, like, that Steven Spielberg made Jaws in what, 77? Is that what
mm-hmm.
it was? Right around the time that...
75 or 76.
75 was...
Okay. Yeah. But it was around the time that Lucas first made the Star Wars movie.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that Spielberg did not go and make Close Encounters after that, and did not go and make Raiders of the Lost Ark. Imagine this parallel Back to the Future universe where Steven Spielberg just made Jaws movies for the next 30 years or whatever it was, and just made...
Oh, God.
Like... animated TV Jaws projects and Jaws video games and Jaws action figures and, like, you know, the movies. He made, like,
five other Jaws movies, and they trace the lineage back of the Quint family and the Brody family, and how long they'd be battling. Like, can you imagine how fucking pathetic it would be? And not only how pathetic it would be, but we would have missed out on all those great movies that he's made in the meantime. And that's how I feel about this. I love the Star Wars movies, the original, or at least the first two. But I feel like we've missed out on what, and I feel like Lucas could have been the filmmaker that Spielberg is. And I feel like we missed out on his Schindler's List, and we missed out on his Color Purples, and his Empire of the Suns, and his Minority Report. So many more interesting movies and projects this guy could have made. And they're gone. We've been raped, we've just gotten this Jaws movie over and over and over again. It's so creatively bankrupt. And I'm sorry if we get hate mail and hate email.
No, but we're not saying anything that hasn't been said before. I think if we didn't like the original movies that much, we wouldn't really care. But it does seem like he turned this – I guess really the downfall really starts, if you really want the honest truth, in 1991 when he gives the licensing and allows authors to write the novels and everything, the comic books and everything. When he starts to turn, it's like when you start to do that, you go back to the well, or you're cannibalizing your own creation. You have all these other people writing these things. And, you know, if you go to the bookstore today, there are, like, I think six different series or something of Star Wars books. You trivialize it. You really, that's the only word I can think to really, you really.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It was trying to build this empire on a foundation that was never really there to begin with. The movies were good. Star Wars and Empire and even Return of the Jedi were good. They weren't great. I mean, they were great to children, but they really are not, like, I mean, it's not the kind of, like, substantial filmmaking, even from an action-adventure point of view. It's not, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and it's not Minority Report. Like, it's not,
I
not quite on that level.
Empire, though, is that oddity, that rarity that's just, I do think, from an adult standpoint, is very good.
I'm just uninterested. I don't care if it's in 3D. I don't care if it's in 4D. I don't care if Princess Leia jumps off the screen and gives me a hand job. I just don't care anymore.
Like, wait, is that an option? Okay. No, dude, I agree with you here, Chris. I just think, you know, my mom even said it best that maybe he should have just gone back and retitled the ones 1, 2, and 3 and just never made the prequels, because the prequels do tarnish, I think, a great legacy.
I'm not even that emotionally attached to it. I don't feel like it tarnishes. I just feel like he just made three bad movies in a row, and a couple of bad cartoon movies, and a couple of bad cartoon TV shows, and action figures, and video games, and, like, it's not like it hurts something from my childhood, because I was never
Star
Wars movie.
I don't even feel that way, the whole rape my childhood. I don't agree with that at all. I understand.
My feeling is that Lucas's creative bankruptcy has come from the point after he finished the whole series, all six films. And he's doing nothing but trying to bleed the well as dry as he can get it after that. It's over. I agree with the observation that his career is monotonous, like doing Jaws for 30 years. But Star Wars was always built on this continuing mythology, this continuing story. And that's what that was his goal. And who knows, that might have been his life's goal. These are the movies I want to make. I'm not
so much
interested in anything else.
Right. But he was at a time, he said that he wanted to go back and make smaller films.
Yeah.
Well, basically
you're right.
He wants to do what Coppola is doing right now. But I just don't see it.
I think he is a visionary. I don't think he's a writer director. I think he's a storyteller. I don't think he's a screenwriter.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'll give you that. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, he was. We all agree that he was at his best when he was producing Empire Strikes Back. That was when he was at his best, when he was able to creatively sort of shepherd this project that was sort of in someone else's hands as a writer and someone else's hands as a director.
Yeah. All right, so that's our latest Star Wars rant.
Okay, great. We're going to get – blame me. Just, Jamie, just have them – just say it's all Jerry's fault. That will – you wash your hands of it.
How about P.C. Anderson's The Master?
Yeah.
It got shut down.
Yeah. We talked about
this. Why do
you have any theories
on this? We talked
about
this a little last show, but yeah. Tell me why you think that is.
Why do I think it got shut down?
Think it's why they're saying it got shut down?
Well, why are they saying? Because of Scientology? Is that what they're saying?
No, they're saying
they're saying that it was P.T. Anderson. They got to a certain point and he like basically hit a brick wall and he didn't know how to overcome that. That's what we heard from the actors.
From a writing point of view, from a story point of view.
From a story point of view. Yeah.
You know, I don't know. If that's what they're saying, then I don't know why any actor, certainly the actors that are attached to this project, who are actors who have worked with him time and again, I don't see why any of them would make a story like that up. And I sort of tend to believe that because the script for There Will Be Blood is sort of a meandering script, and I can see where maybe that was sort of written. You know, it doesn't exactly move from point A to point B. It sort of feels like it was written more like a novel. In fact, it was based on a novel, loosely. And I would argue that Magnolia sort of feels the same way, too, even though it sort of comes around and ties its knots at the end. So maybe that is true. Maybe he had something to say but couldn't figure out exactly how to say it, which is unfortunate. I just wish he would make anything. You know, I was thinking about that when I was watching the Clint Eastwood movie the other day, which is Clint Eastwood, at the very least, makes about a movie a year, sometimes two. They're B's and B pluses and sometimes A's, but rarely C's and really never D's or F's.
Right.
Clint Eastwood was a very dependable director who occasionally for me stumbles into art. P.T. Anderson has kind of a different identity, and I think the creative spirit has to find him and has to move him before he moves.
Yeah, I know. I agree with that completely. I'm just saying I wish that weren't the case. I love the guy's movies, and I wish he would get off his artsy farty ass and make another one of awesome fucking
movie. It's
they
a
all
void.
You know,
it's a void there. It's definitely, you feel it. There's a hole there.
I mean, Eastwood doesn't write his own scripts.
No, I'm not comparing Eastwood to P.T. Anderson. I'm simply saying Eastwood, as a director, makes a movie a year. I wish more directors could be like that. And I agree with you. Eastwood is someone who stumbles. It's hard for someone to be the Beatles, which is they make an album, sometimes two a year, and by the way, they all are some of the greatest albums ever fucking made. There's no director that's quite like that. Directors are more like Eastwood, which is they make solid movies year in, year out, sometimes two a year, or they're more like P.T. Anderson, or Quentin Tarantino for that matter, which is I'm going to make a movie every 5 or 6 years, and they're going to be really good, and they're going to have a cult following, but you're going to have to wait a long time in between pictures. I don't think that we have a director right now that's pumping out a movie a year, and they're all fucking great.
That's true. That's true. Speaking of that, another director of Anderson's generation or in that group, David O. Russell's The Fighter, the trailer's come out.
Yes.
And that looks, I think that looks very good.
And it'll be sort of the first time in a while that he's just doing kind of a straightforward movie. I Heart Huckabee certainly had a lot of, I don't know what you would call that, but sort of a tangential storyline. I guess Three Kings would be the last time that he made a movie that was that straightforward.
Right.
So you're talking about 10, 11 years. It does look really, really good, and this was a movie that was a long time in the making and went through a lot of directors and a lot of actors, and sort of, from everything I understand, kind of made it through the shooting without any problems.
Given the two volatile personalities,
Yeah. And his last project, just sort of died in limbo, and sort of half shot. I think it looks great. The trailer looks fantastic. We're finally getting to see a lot of the trailers that for a long time it was like, hey, when are we going to see a trailer for this? Like The Fighter and True Grit and Hereafter.
Yeah, that's
we're
another
finally,
one.
Finally
that
seeing
looks
previews
incredible.
For all three of those movies, and all three of them look fantastic, which is great news.
Yeah, True Grit does look terrific. And Chris, you and I were chatting back and forth. The big shocker is And I read another review of it today in EW, Let Me In, where EW even says, you know, I kind of prefer this version to Let the Right One In.
Yeah, I read that. One more person that's saying that, which is just a shocking thing. Like, if you'd asked me 3 months ago, will anyone prefer this version to the original version, I would have said, yeah, maybe a couple nut jobs, maybe one or two nut jobs, some weirdo internet reviewer, some, you know, some nobody, or Armand White, same thing, by the way, for that matter.
He'll probably hate it now that so many people like it.
Yeah, exactly. I'll bet you anything that Armand White had a review of this movie chambered saying it was brilliant. And now that everyone's saying it's actually brilliant, he's deleting that entire review.
Yeah, I agree.
I'll look it up now. Maybe it's up because his Social Network review is up.
Did he like it?
A movie that up until his review came out was like 100% rated on Rotten Tomatoes.
Of course.
He essentially says that the Social Network is no Soul Man.
No Soul Man.
Oh yes. My! Wow.
Soul Man got Harvard Life right in a way that Social Network does not.
Wow, okay.
Did Armand White go to Harvard?
No, he went to... Oh, I can't remember, but I've read where he went to.
My dad went to Harvard, but it's a totally different Harvard than he went to, that's for sure.
Let Me In, he says in the headline, watch out for an awful mashup of teen anguish and vampires in Let Me In. Let Me In ought to be rated NC-17 due to the problematic nature of its vague concept, which has to do with incest and pedophilia. Actually, that is the difference between, as I understand it, the main difference between this remake and the original is that the father's role is more fleshed out and very creepily so.
Mm.
Yeah,
played
yeah.
by Richard Jenkins.
From what I understand, that's a lot closer to the source book, which the original film was based on. What we're finding out is that movie is the movie that was untrue to the source material in a lot of ways, actually. And this movie is much, much closer, from what I understand. So I'm really sort of foaming at the mouth to see this thing.
Yeah, likewise.
But even the people that love it will say that if you've seen the original, it's still very, very reminiscent of the original.
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of goes in directions and sort of plays notes that the original didn't quite have the balls, no pun intended, to make. So it really, really, Matt Reeves, welcome. Because I liked Cloverfield. It felt like a movie that almost anyone could have made, but it was very, very well done.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I'm always interested when someone follows up a movie with another successful movie. Or with another good movie.
Right.
So many directors just sort of fizzle out. You know, we were talking to Thomas Jane earlier, and I see on his IMDb that he's making a movie with Mark Pellington. And I remember when Arlington Road came out, that Mark Pellington seemed like the next fucking awesome director. Like,
right.
Felt like we were going to see a movie from Mark Pellington within a couple years that kicked ass. In fact, I think I was not the only one that felt that way. A lot of reviewers felt the same way.
Mm-hmm.
About Arlington Road and about Mothman Prophecies, which is a lesser movie but very well directed. And then Mark Pellington fucking disappeared.
That's 2002, right? Mothman Prophecies? About 2002.
Something like that. It feels like longer ago than that. But he's made movies since then, but he didn't quite deliver, and who knows, maybe he still will, but I'm glad to see that Matt Reeves, I'm glad to see that we've got a new rookie class, as I always say. Like, I like to see new guys, new blood coming in and
of
doing
course.
Well, not just making one movie and disappearing. You know, good for him.
Yeah. TV adaptations, this is one I never thought that I'd see. Paul Haggis is once again using Russell Crowe for a feature film version of The Equalizer. Remember that show?
Yeah. Who are they going to get to play The Equalizer, out of curiosity? I mean,
I don't know. Wouldn't that be Russell Crowe?
Oh, Russell Crowe's a... Oh, God, I hope there are no phones on the set. Jesus Christ.
Yeah,
I
mean,
I don't know
yeah.
this show. Maybe I'm just a couple years too old, but I don't know this one. I mean, I don't know. I must be too old. I don't know.
It was a good show with Everett Woodward.
I'm older. It might be that you're too young.
I think I am.
Yeah, it's like in the 80s, but it was a good show. I was thinking this because Now, that would be better, though, I think, as a TV. Maybe if they did it, went back and did it as a TV show. But who knows? I mean, they're going back and making everything, like the Green Hornet they're making into a movie. So who? I guess everything is going to be in a movie now.
Yeah, which Sally Minky edited.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Also, I had another story. Robert Zemeckis is returning to live-action directing.
Yeah. Last live-action movie was 11 years ago, or 10 years ago, Castaway, which is a great movie.
Yeah, that is a great movie.
This awful, you know, they called Prohibition the Noble Experiment. We got to come up with a name for Zemeckis' experiment here. It certainly isn't fucking noble. But it's weird. It's got to be awful for Zemeckis. Like, he made three of these movies, and none of them connected at all with audiences. Mm-hmm. Avatar comes out, and fucking Cameron nails it first shot. Like, that fucking kill him. like, you know he's cursing Cameron's name somewhere, and Cameron's just laughing his ass off on a pile of money.
Well, what always bugged me about Christmas Carol, you have this, what is a great cast. Why would you want to animate them?
Oh, listen, you know? It was the same with Beowulf.
Yeah, true. Mm-hmm.
And it was the same with the first one. Which,
the Polar Express, yeah.
Yeah, the Polar Express. Like, why the fuck? Like, listen, I said it with Beowulf. I'll say it again. Like, I've said it 1,000 times. I will say it once again. Angelina Jolie is the most fuckable woman on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Zemeckis made her unfuckable.
That's quite a skill to
like.
According to Jose in the chat room, Jose says that Pellington disappeared from films because his wife died. He went through a traumatic phase. Not to bring it down from Angelina Jolie, but
no, listen, I went through a traumatic phase when I saw her in Beowulf, with the animated tits. You know, like I said, Mark Pellington having a down period in his career does not take away from the fact that I love Arlington Road, and
it's
I like Moth
film.
And Prophecies. I like Moth
like
and Prophecies very much. I like Mark Pellington, and like I said, I hope that he does make that movie, and maybe he will. I'm just saying that I'm happy that Matt Reeves is like Zack Snyder. When Zack Snyder made Dawn of the Dead, no one had ever heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
And Zack Snyder sort of came out of nowhere with this movie. And then I was happy to see that he followed it up with 300, which was very successful. I didn't like it, but it was successful, and that was great. And it gave him the opportunity to go and make Watchmen, which is a movie I did like very much. And now
mm-hmm.
I feel like Zack Snyder, now he might get the Superman job, which I think he'd be perfect for. You know what I mean? Like, I
mm-hmm.
like when guys try and succeed. I get happy about that.
I agree with you. And Watchmen is a movie that gets better with each viewing, I think. So
absolutely. I was saying that to someone the other day.
And also, look what Zack Snyder – it's ironic because Zack Snyder's new movie is also at the 3D Film Festival, his new movie, the one with the owls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's
that's
kind of an odd leap from 300 and Watchmen, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. But, you know, I mean, good for him. I like
good for him, yeah.
Be,
and he's got Sucker Punch next year.
Yeah, Sucker Punch, which could be big.
Yes.
You know, like, he's all over the place, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Another of those guys from Mark Pellington's era that disappeared for a long time and then came back, and he's not directing anything worthy of his earlier gifts was Phil Juanu. I expected a real nice, colorful career from him.
Yeah.
I mean, he
Need
made
another one.
You Two Rattle
State
and Hums, State of Grace, the Heavenly Creatures movie that really, I think, soured his feelings about filmmaking at that time. Because I guess Alec Baldwin was a real terror on that set, and it was just in post-production hell. I guess it sat on the shelf forever. It was one of those kind of, will this thing ever come out? Why don't you just go ahead and release it? Because it's the stink isn't going to come off of it,
what
no matter how long you wait.
Which movie?
Yeah, it's Heaven. Heaven something.
Prisoners. Heaven's Prisoners.
Oh yeah.
Heaven's Prisoners
is
the Peter Jackson movie.
No. Based on a great series of books. I love those books, but the movie.
Yeah.
And then he disappeared, and then he came back for something like Gridiron Gang with The Rock.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. Like, that's what I'm talking about with Mark Pellington and guys like Zack Snyder. Like, I don't want them to go the Phil Juanu route. I don't want them to go the Jonathan Glazer route, which is make Sexy Beasts one of the greatest movies of the last 20 years, mm-hmm. and then followed up with Birth, which is a very interesting movie, something I like very much, and then fucking disappear for the last 10 years. Like, please, like, just go ahead and make something. Like,
yeah, come,
I do
please
feel
come
like,
back. Please come
yeah,
back.
Yeah, I feel like Tarantino and P.T. Anderson could sort of take a page out of these guys' book, which is maybe try, I know that you're an auteur, and I know that you need to control, like, the fucking artistic spirit needs to move you or whatever, but I feel like you could take a page out of Eastwood's book and just read a script, say, hey, I like this, I want to make this, just so that you can, like, you know, mm-hmm. sort of fucking pad your resume with it.
Right,
no. Flick, you know
you're
what
right.
I mean? Like, I sort of wish those guys could do that, could once in a while be a director for hire.
Well,
and I do feel like good directors do that. Like, Brian De Palma is a perfect example. Like, Brian De Palma starts projects and shepherds them from beginning to end sometimes, and then sometimes he says, hey, listen, this Mission Impossible script is not bad. It's good money. I'm going to make this. And I like that he's got that on his resume. I wish Tarantino and P.T. Anderson, well, I don't think P.T. Anderson should make the next Mission Impossible movie. Let me be clear here. But
yeah.
I do feel like, I feel
no,
like
I,
he could make some good flicks.
It's one of Kubrick towards the end, and I think it's a documentary that's on the, well, on the Dr. Strangelove DVD that I have, said, you know, one of his regrets was, you know, I didn't make enough films.
Yes.
And he regretted that horribly. I mean, towards the end, he really was, and I think maybe the same could be said probably of David Lean. There's another one. You know?
Yeah, I think he'd probably regret it more if he actually made a lot of films and they weren't up to caliber of the ones that he did bank.
Right.
Some people, I mean, it's the way they work. Maybe what he's apologizing for is the way he works,
mm-hmm.
you know, more than
yeah.
anything else.
You
know, I have terrific admiration for Kubrick. I just don't enjoy many of his films.
Right. Well, what about, all right, we're talking about this. What about someone like Terrence Malick?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, he fits perfectly in this category.
Yeah.
I mean, I really feel like that was more of a choice of his to sort of walk
mm-hmm.
away from directing in between Days of Heaven.
He was like the John Hughes that actually came back to film. Yeah.
Which, who knows, John Hughes might have done that. You know, I feel like he might have at some point.
He could have, yeah.
Because he stayed in the game. He was very much writing and very much producing for the duration of the time that he was not directing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's shocking. I mean, this is like, Terrence Malick all of a sudden is Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
I mean, he's shooting his new movie before his other new one that hasn't come out yet comes out. You know?
Right.
He'll be done.
Yeah.
He'll be done shooting by the time his new movie comes out.
Yeah. Well, Tree of Life, like, the fucking thing wrapped, like, fucking Bush was still president when the thing wrapped production, or wrapped fucking photography. Like, I mean, this thing's been wrapped for a long time. I feel like I saw that shot of Brad Pitt with the kid on his shoulders, like, 4 years ago or something like that for
right.
this movie. So, and the thing is, I like Thin Red Line very much. I feel like New World did not get its due. So I feel like maybe he was sort of getting his sea legs back with Thin Red Line, and I feel like he got him back with New World. And I'm very excited to see what's going to go on with Tree of Life in this next movie he's making, because it seems by looking at the progress that he's made in the last 10 years since Thin Red Line came out, it seems like the next one should be like the greatest movie ever made, right?
Because right.
He got exponentially better with his last two movies. So what? Just release it. Like, just didn't we learn anything from Kubrick and Eyes Wide Shut? Did no one learn anything from that? Like, you do want to be alive when this thing comes out, right? Like, go ahead and wrap it to a
final. Yeah, no, you're
and
right.
Then let it go.
Well, and he feels very bullish about Tree of Life. He feels great about it. Like I've said before on the show, he says it's his best since Badlands. And I, honestly, Badlands is my first favorite Malick movie, and The New World is my second,
mm-hmm.
which shocked
yeah.
me. Because I wasn't taken by The Thin Red Line. There's such a thin line between profound and pretentious, And, you know, it really crossed the line into pretentiousness for me. Thin Red Line did. But The New World is absolutely ethereal. It is transcendent. You get lost
in
it.
That's the key word. Yeah, transcendent. You're absolutely right.
Which is
in
how Badlands was
on a
different note.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, and Days of Heaven wanted to be that, and I'm sure it is. I have to reassess Days of Heaven. But his movies are the kind that, gosh, you really have to sit down and commit to them, you know?
No, you don't. That's a commitment,
dude. Oh, it's like taking a hit of acid. Like, it's not, I mean, like, you need to fucking, like, strap yourself in like fucking Buzz Aldrin and sit down because this thing's going to be on for 3 hours and this shit's going to get heavy. Like, this is
all I'm doing right now.
Yeah,
I'm
interesting.
Just completely focused.
You bring that up about The Thin Red Line because a lot of people, like, when that came out, I still have mixed feelings about it. I think there's some things that work and there are other things that are just like, wow, whatever. I don't think it's this perfect film by any stretch of the imagination. Like you said, it is an investment.
Well, like Jamie said, there's a line between something being powerful and being pretentious.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that the movie sits on either side of that line. I think it, like, sort of skips back and forth across that line.
You're right.
Like, I think there are moments of it that work very, very well. And then there are moments of it, sometimes for 10 to 15 minutes, where it definitely is on that pretentious side of the line.
Well,
right.
And it's the danger with him, because Thomas Jane just expressed it in that interview when he was talking about working with Malick on Thin Red Line. He says they were in the middle of a scene, and Terrence Malick and his DP just disappeared and came back half hour later. And he was like, what happened? He said, well, no, we saw the most beautiful butterfly. We just had to film it. And Thomas Jane was like, okay. He was just left, like, high and dry in the middle of his scene.
Yeah, the butterfly got billing over Thomas Jane and John C. Reilly.
Oh, the actors that were in that movie that
disappear
in the final cut.
Yeah,
well, I can understand from an actor's point of view, like from Thomas Jane's point of view, from John C. Reilly's point of view, you know, you probably take a pay cut. You probably say, well, it's Terrence Malick, so, yeah, normally I get $1 million a picture, but I'll take, $200,000 to make a Terrence Malick movie. You go down
and
there.
Especially, he's been gone 20 years. He's
right.
a Howard Hughes figure.
Right, so you take one-fifth of your normal pay, you go down there, you spend 3 months on what would normally be a three-week shoot, and then when the movie comes out, guess who's not in it? You. Like, you don't even feel it.
Yeah, you're
literally
right.
Like, there's literally like a 3.5 second shot of you smoking a cigarette and then flicking it, and it doesn't hit the ground before the scene cuts away, and you're not in the movie for the rest of the movie, you know? Like, I can understand John C. Reilly saying, fuck Terrence Malick, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he did. Did he say that? Did John C. Reilly say
that? I don't think that's a quote, no.
I wouldn't. But I understand.
Don't quote me on that.
Yeah, it's going to appear in the news tomorrow.
Malick takes on this almost like what David Lean did with Ryan's daughter. It just took forever. They spent like a month just to shoot like 1 minute of footage. And, you know, from an actor's, I understand, like, from an actor's perspective, where that's very just like, why am I doing this?
Yeah, an actor's, the appeal of working with legendary directors, especially when the opportunities to work with those directors are so rare, accounts for Eyes Wide Shut, too. I mean, that's probably why Keitel and Jennifer Jason Leigh jumped on that film.
Right.
You know, Jennifer Jason Leigh is one story because she was recast in production. But Harvey Keitel just got sick and tired of waiting. Harvey Keitel doesn't suffer fools, I guess. So
he just walked
out.
When he got
and he
fired
did three movies that nobody
now,
knows.
He said, thank you.
Yeah.
He did three movies and that nobody remembers.
Right, exactly.
But
Keitel's got to go make a Fockers movie or something, you know? Like,
yeah,
it's not like he went off and made...
What does he play? Who does he play
he played
in that
the,
movie?
I think he played the Sidney... Oh, you're talking about the Fockers? Oh, you're talking about Eyes Wide Shut. Because I do believe that he played the Sidney Pollack part.
Right, yeah.
Yes.
In the Fockers movie, I think he plays just like a handyman or something like that.
Oh, okay, wow.
I don't think he's part of the family.
It's like, this is called a monkey trouble?
Which I think he's especially suited for. I have a controversial position about Harvey Keitel that I actually don't think he's a good actor. I think his bravery exceeds his skill.
And that's why
he's gotten the notice that he has in his career.
I agree with you, and that's also, I would take it a step further, that's why he has not gotten the awards that maybe some people think he should. Because I don't think he's ever had any one performance that has been, you know, like head and shoulders above his other performances. He's always Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
Whether it's Last Temptation of Christ or Clockers or Reservoir Dogs or Bad Lieutenant, it doesn't matter what it is. He's always Harvey Keitel. He's always very good at being Harvey Keitel. He's sort of like, I would argue, he's sort of, Mark Wahlberg is sort of the Harvey Keitel of his of our day and age.
No, like, but Harvey never talked to a plant like that, though.
If you... listen, you go back and watch. You go back and sift through his career. I promise you, you will find something almost as embarrassing as The Happening.
Just do the Finding Graceland movie.
Finding Graceland is pretty bad. And Monkey Trouble, too. The one that I do like from him a lot, that is like the standout, if you will, is City of Industry. I think that's the one.
It's a standout movie. It's a good movie and sort of an unpraised movie. But his performance, I don't know that his performance, like, I couldn't agree more with Jamie on this one, actually. Like, mm-hmm. I like Harvey Keitel, but I don't
think
he's...
That's a first.
Oh, come on. You ass. We agree all
the time. I see what you're saying. I think there's a scene in there, there's one scene that I think is sort of a standout, but no, you're right. It is Harvey Keitel. It's not Harvey Keitel playing this character. It's Harvey Keitel playing Harvey Keitel. Even in Clockers, you're right. It is Harvey.
Even the piano, which is considered to be like his different sort of quieter performance, he's still the same guy. He's just not as loud. Like, he's on volume level 3 instead of volume 10 or 11 if we were in Final Cut.
In the great movies that he's done, you remember the great movies that he's done, and you never really think his performance made that movie greater. He comes across great because the movie is great, and some people might think that's unfair. But if you think that's unfair, look at a truly great actor, Gene Hackman. Look how many crap movies he did where he was outstanding in them, where he enhanced the movie just by being in it.
You don't even think Mean Streets? You don't even think his part in Mean Streets?
No, same thing, Jerry. I agree with Jamie completely on this.
Okay, I'm just trying to name some things here, but
he's done great movies. I mean, that's it. He's got half a dozen, seven, eight
Winston
great
Wolf
movies
in
on his
Pulp
resume.
Fiction. Same thing.
I do think he's incredibly brave and ballsy. And to prove it, he shows his balls in a lot of movies.
Hey, I was going to talk about something else real quick.
Okay. Sure.
Shifting gears here, if nobody minds.
I saw
two movies recently, two Vince Vaughn movies, both of which were panned, completely, universally panned. Couples Retreat, Four Christmases. I got to say, Couples Retreat, nowhere near as bad as everyone said it was. It's a funny movie, it's a cute movie, and it wasn't great, but it was a solid B, you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? Like, just a funny movie that you could watch and sort of giggle at, and then,
right.
you know, it ends and you don't mind. Four Christmases?
You don't mind.
Did not get its due for being as bad and like as offensively and like bad in sort of a shrill, like annoying kind mm-hmm. of way. Like, it's one of the worst movies that I've seen in many, many, many years. And it's
really?
One of these movies where,
I've never seen it, so I don't know.
I didn't have any interest in seeing it. I recorded it because I figured my wife's into romantic comedies and if I want to get her to watch a movie with me, it's usually going to be a romantic comedy. So we watched it, and it's one of these movies where, like, they sort of seem to think, a lot of comedies do this these days, they sort of seem to think a lot of laughs come from family members just sort of screaming at each other, you know, like, and a lot of people, like, spend time in this movie just screaming at each other, and I guess it's supposed to be funny, but it's not. It's just,
no, it's
and how,
really
and how
really
eccentric
really
can
real.
We make the brothers and the grandmother?
Oh, my
and...
God, like. Everybody in this movie is more annoying than the last character that's been introduced. Like, I mean, this movie did not get its due. I feel like, actually, Couples Retreat got treated more harshly by the critics than Four Christmases did. People sort of dismissed Four Christmases.
It's awful. I mean, I really, like, almost recommend that people watch it to see how bad and how annoying it is. Zero laughs.
Let me ask you.
And I like Vince Vaughn. And I
we all love him.
Robert Duvall and John Voight and Mary Steenburgen and Dwight Yoakam. It's got a lot of interesting people in it. Zero laughs.
Well, we had the director. We had Seth Gordon on.
I love his first movie, his documentary. Fantastic.
Yeah, we love it too. That's why we had him on. He was talking about that, and he was shooting Four Christmases, and I asked him about it at the end. And you could kind of tell that he was kind of not really excited about it. That's around the time that those rumors about Vince Vaughn and Reese Witherspoon at each other's throats were in the
Ask you this, Chris, because I was thinking about Couples Retreat the other day because it was on cable. Do you think that would have maybe in hindsight, just given the characters and everything, there would have worked better as a sitcom maybe?
I thought you were going to say it worked better as a drama with some comedy. Like, I feel like that's the kind of movie. Couples Retreat has laughs in it, and it's actually kind of a good story. It's a good setup, and it's got a really good cast. Which could be said about Four Christmases, too. Four Christmases has a fantastic cast.
Oh, yeah.
Couples Retreat has an equally good cast. But Couples Retreat in the hands of somebody like Woody Allen, as opposed to... I mean, the movie was written by Favreau and Vince Vaughn, who, of course, wrote Swingers and made very funny movies. But it was directed by Peter Billingsley, who's their longtime producing partner, and, of course, Kitchen Christmas Story and Dirt by Kid and all that stuff. But and he's not an untalented director, but the movie just doesn't quite add up to the sum of its parts. But in the hands of somebody like Woody Allen, a more of a drama with some comedy in it about these couples going off on a retreat together, it really could have worked very, very well. And even you wouldn't even have to go as far as Woody Allen. I feel like in the hands of somebody like John Favreau, much stronger.
Or even a Paul Mazursky, maybe. Yes,
who John Favreau might have a lot in common with. It's not that bad. Like, it's really not that bad at all. But Four Christmases
is really that bad.
It has scenes, it has scenes that go on for long periods of time that are, like, shockingly unfunny and trying, like, literally the attempt knob is turned up to 10 on looking for laughs, and they're just falling flat just continually over and over again. And it is weird because Seth Gordon, that's his name, right? Seth Gordon?
Yeah.
That King of Kong movie, Fistful of Quarters, is a documentary that doesn't always try for laughs, or maybe it does, but it's just loaded soup to nuts with laughs,
it's
moments.
It's very entertaining, yeah.
I mean, it's just fucking loaded, and this movie has zero.
Here's two other big stories. Mission Impossible 4 is definitely happening. They're about to shoot it. One of the locations they're shooting in is Dubai. And they just cast, obviously, Tom Cruise, Jeremy Renner's in it. They just cast Josh Holloway from Lost.
Yeah, Sawyer. Yeah.
Cool. That's a great choice.
It is a great choice. He's perfect.
Well, it depends on what he's playing. I mean, if he's playing the female love interest, it's not a great choice.
Well, no, it's not a great choice, obviously. But, you know, I think...
If you're a Lost fan, you know who he's playing. He's going to be playing a Sawyer-like character. I don't know that there's anybody else that Josh Holloway. I don't want to. I don't want to talk about him as an actor. But he's great.
I'm not talking bad about him, but I'm sure he's probably going to play Tom Cruise's foe, maybe, because the rest of the cast is Tom Cruise. Well, yeah, Ving Rhames is back, and Simon Pegg is in it too. The other big news about Superman reboot. Did you hear who is the major contender now to direct it?
I've heard that there's five people that Nolan is interested in, and they were Tony Scott, Zack Snyder, what's his name that just made the Let Me In movie, Matt Reeves, a couple others. I don't remember them right off the top of my head. Who is it?
I think Matt Reeves would be a good choice, but they're going with Darren Aronofsky.
I don't know.
And then they're thinking that Natalie Portman will play Lois Lane.
Yeah.
Which I can see that. I mean, that's not offensive.
That's not what we're worried about, Lois Lane. Although that's a better choice than Kate Bosworth, but still.
I think Kate Bosworth was great. The guy who played Superman was great. The problem was, I don't think that we're interested in Superman movies anymore. But back to Darren Aronofsky. Darren Aronofsky sort of gets kissed into the category of people like Quentin Tarantino and P.T. Anderson. And in my opinion, and I'm very excited about Black Swan, but I don't feel like Darren Aronofsky has quite earned his place into that category yet. I think he's an interesting choice for Superman. I don't think he's wrong for it. Like, he might be very, very good at it, although he's unproven in that genre, completely unproven.
Well,
I
don't know. Be honest with you. I don't know.
He is not consistently strong the way that P.T. Anderson is. You know what I mean? And I hate to compare directors like that, but The Fountain is very, very much a miss. We're almost unanimously decided on that. Are we
I think
not?
So.
No, I'm not. I actually do like that one a lot, but I'm going to concede to you, Chris. I can see where people do not like that film.
And we just got an email from a fan of ours that said, could you guys do a new classic show on The Fountain? Ironically enough. Yeah.
I like The Fountain, but Chris, I understand when we first talked about
and
it.
And I wrote him back and I said, well, Jerry can do it.
Yeah, Jerry can do it, yeah.
Listen,
do like the film.
I think Requiem for a Dream is a fucking masterpiece. I think it's an A. I think it's an A+. I think it's a fucking 11 on a scale of 1 to 10.
Mm-hmm. Dude, let me just tell you, Chris, that your Tourette's is, like, really acting up tonight.
No, but I understand where Chris is coming from about The Fountain. We talked about this a couple of years ago.
Are you talking about the swearing? Is the swearing too much?
No, the swearing's great. I love the swearing. But
if it's too much, tell me, and I'll really...
No, you're not swearing enough tonight,
that's
actually.
That's fine. We're cutting all this out anyway. No,
But what about pie? Does anyone like pie, or...?
Depends on who's pie. But my point about Superman is this. I think the choice of Darren Aronofsky, it's not finalized yet. It's at the rumor stage now, but, you know, who knows who that rumor's generating from. It could be an insider that really knows the process. That choice shows me that this Superman has real promise. That this Superman is thinking outside of the box, it's wanting to be different, it's truly trying to reinvigorate the franchise, and couple that with Christopher Nolan and his brother being behind the conception of this reboot, and I think that we don't really have that much of a reason to be as doubtful as we would if Salkind was hiring somebody to write.
Well, that's the thing, though. Here's the problem with all of this. While these are all great directors, and this is where Bryan Singer fumbles too, Bryan Singer really loves Richard Donner, and it's really like a Richard Donner film. But here's the problem. Superman can't be like Batman. It's just not that Superman really – maybe the problem with Superman, and Chris said this a couple minutes ago, maybe we're just over Superman. We don't live in a day and age where Superman is going to work.
I think we're over that conception of Superman. If they're brave enough, and Christopher Nolan showed that he was with Batman, if they're brave enough to break the mythology, the restrictions of the mythology,
mm-hmm.
and deepen it somehow, like he did with Batman.
I don't know that that's true. First of all, I don't think it's right to say that Chris Nolan was the one that broke those molds with Batman, because it was done by Frank Miller, long before Chris Nolan did it.
Right.
Chris Nolan would say that. And the thing is, it hasn't been done by anybody else in the comic book world with Superman, and the reason it hasn't been done is because they tried to do it. They tried to reinvent Superman with the death of Superman and then the rebirth of Superman and Steel and all these other forms, and it didn't work.
It didn't work at all.
And so what they did was go back to the original Superman, and it's this guy that's completely infallible. He has no flaws. He's completely uninteresting. And that's what works in the comic to a lesser degree, because Superman comics are nowhere near as popular as the other comics on the market, and they're nowhere near as popular as they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you that the fact that Chris Nolan and his brother are behind the project gives me a lot of hope. The fact that they're looking to hire someone like Darren Aronofsky gives me a lot of hope. But the Superman character, to me, is completely uninteresting. And, Jamie, you said it best yourself a long time ago, long before the Bryan Singer remake came out, which is, like, Superman is sort of infallible and has one weakness, and it's kryptonite. So it's like every time there's a Superman movie and the villain, you know, I mean, it's like there's no surprises. It's like a James Bond movie.
He's old-fashioned. He's boring. Every single movie is the same way. I mean, obviously the Donner 1 and 2, because Donner really directed most of 2.
Yeah, but
They're both shining examples of how it can be done very competently and entertainingly. But once you see that, I mean, you know the plot course of every other Superman movie.
Yeah, right. But I think
how are we going to get him?
Bill
says
in Volume 2.
Yeah.
It's what David Carradine says in Volume 2 really sums up Superman beautifully, and that really is the problem. I don't see really. It doesn't matter who you get to do it. Bryan Singer tried it, and he took it so seriously that it hurt the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it really hurt the film. Don't get me wrong, I think there are some great moments in that movie. But as a whole, it feels like a rehashing of the first one.
Yeah.
And maybe with a Superman, Bryan Singer's version notwithstanding, maybe with a Superman thing... It's akin to the Bond thing, where the Broccoli's had such stranglehold control over it that they all felt the same. Maybe it's the same way with the Salkinds with Superman, and now that we're in a different generation, that they don't have to follow those rules anymore.
Right. Well, we'll see. We'll see what they can do. But I think that's a good analogy between Bond and Superman. The one time they went outside the box with James Bond with a different actor on Her Majesty's Secret Service, which I think actually might be one of the best ones. No one liked it. It's aged very well. Even Diana Rigg likes it at this point, I think, even though she hated it and used to put garlic in her mouth before each scene with George Lazenby. But when they went outside the box, you know, it pissed off a lot of people at the time.
Yeah.
And Superman, you know, I would say Aronofsky's a great choice. I think Zack Snyder or Reeves would be a great choice, too.
Yeah, but I think Reeves would be a great choice. But somebody that hasn't made anything remotely resembling a comic book-type movie. I mean, Aronofsky is a pretty daring, gritty director.
He was going to do Batman Year One before Nolan was involved.
He was going to do RoboCop too.
Yeah.
So he's obviously interested in doing an action adventure type thing.
You're
but listen, you know, Ang Lee was an outside the box choice for Hulk. And I like the movie, but I'm obviously in the minority because most of the people in the world thought that Ang Lee's Hulk sucked.
It was fascinating.
I thought it was fascinating, too, but people's complaint, the majority of people, Jerry, disagree with you and I. Like, the majority of the people said that it was boring, and the problem was not Eric Bana, and the problem was not the effects. The problem was that the pacing of the movie was boring, you know? And I feel like Aronofsky might be in that same sort of – I don't want to – listen – he hasn't even gotten the job yet, so I don't want to judge
We don't want to curse him that much.
People don't watch the Hulk to be fascinated.
Yeah.
It reminds me of an interview I was reading with Anthony Hopkins where they asked him about Dracula. It was at the time of the release of Dracula. And the interviewer said, I didn't think it was scary. And Anthony Hopkins said, you're right, it wasn't scary. It wasn't very sexy either, but it was funny, wasn't it? And the interviewer was like, yeah, but you don't watch Francis Coppola's Dracula movie for funny. So that was funny. I'm looking right now at posters for upcoming Sony movies. Here's the poster for Men in Black 3 in 3D. Next to it is the poster for Spider-Man 4 3D.
Is that what they're calling it, Spider-Man 4?
They're calling it Spider-Man 3D, but it's a fourth Spider-Man. Next to that is the Smurfs in 3D.
Oh, God.
The Smurfs will be – I guarantee you, I'm not sure about Men in Black because that second Men in Black was wretched. But
just minor,
sure,
you know?
Yeah, very, very minor. Spider-Man, obviously, will be massive. But I bet the Smurfs will be really big.
I hope you're wrong.
I don't think he is wrong. I think he's probably very right. Listen, Alvin and the Chipmunks was very strong. Look,
that's true. Yeah. I mean, if we're going on that basis, my God, then Yogi Bear will be like a catapult.
We've gotten reboots and TV remakes for so long now that the audience is no longer the people who grew up watching these shows. The audience now is people who grew up watching these shows are going to take their kids to them. Alvin and the Chipmunks, the Smurfs, Yogi Bear, these are the kind of movies that people are taking their kids to because they're like, hey, we're going to take you to see Alvin and the Chipmunks. Cause I used to watch Alvin and the Chipmunks when I was a kid, you know? So,
sure.
The Smurfs is going to be the same way. Smurfs is probably going to be a huge, huge hit.
It'll do great in Europe.
I think it's pathetic. Like, I think it's sad. Like, I'm waiting for someone to do a sort of, like, a joke 3D movie. You know what I mean? Like, I'm waiting for someone like Woody Allen to make a 3D movie, you know? Like, just one of his regular movies, not, like, anything special, just a regular movie made in 3D, just as a gag, you know? Maybe not even as a gag. Maybe someone to really test that theory of James Cameron's, which is that every movie should be made in 3D, would make every movie better. Like, I'm waiting for someone to just make a straight-up drama or a straight-up comedy in 3D and see if filming a movie in 3D does make it a more interesting viewing experience and not just when you have 9-foot blue people running around and shooting each other with arrows.
That's the question. That's the question. If is every movie truly suited for 3D? Is an intimate character drama suited for 3D? Can it enhance the experience of that movie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think so. I think some.
I don't think so either.
I think 3D is an application that you know, you apply it if the material warrants it.
Yeah,
I agree with you. Yeah,
And that's not that's not degrading the promise or the power of 3D.
No, not at all.
Because the biggest movie ever made warranted the use of 3D. You know.
Yeah, it's like arguing that every movie should be made in sepia tone. It's like. Francis Ford Coppola, after he made Godfather 2, arguing that sepia tone is the greatest tone for filmmaking, and every movie should be made in sepia tone. You know what I mean? It's just like photography. Like, there are some shots...
And that's
that
not true. Every David Fincher movie should be made in sepia tone.
Some shots call for black and white. Some shots call for sepia tone. Some shots call for vivid color. Some shots call for, you know, like other aspects. You know, like, 3D is the same way. It works for Avatar. Maybe it'll work for this new Scorsese movie. Maybe it works for Piranha 3D. By all accounts, it does. I don't know that it needs to be made for every movie. And I don't think it's going to last very long, unfortunately, because we're getting so many Clash of the Titans and we're getting so many retrofitted movies. You know, the Titanic and the Star Wars and the Lord of the Rings and things like that. I think it's going to be diminishing returns, I think, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And people are
right.
Are going to be less and less able to make the distinction between something that has been retrofitted for 3D and something that has been shot in 3D. James Cameron says he can show you that there's no difference, but I am doubtful of that. I'm very, very doubtful of that.
Oh, watch yourself.
I know. I hate to doubt Cameron.
I don't want
to. I'm not out and out doubting Cameron, but listen, the thing is, it's not like James Cameron can wipe away your memory of having seen Titanic. So it's not going to be as shocking to see Titanic in 3D as it was to see Avatar in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it is great, even if it is seamless, as he says it will be, even if it will be the gold standard, it won't have the effect on people that it will movie filmed in 3D because they're not seeing it for the first time. It's not just the 3D effects that are important. It's the story and the performances and the script and the direction. And these things can't be recreated in 3D. You've already seen them.
And I can see that if it works, that'll be a real kind of visceral jaw-dropper from the first frame of Titanic. I mean, when you see the boat coming out of the, you know. towards you in the water from the submersible. Did you see the new trailer from the new Ron Howard movie?
No, I haven't. What?
It's called The Dilemma. Speaking of Vince Vaughn, Vince Vaughn and Kevin James are in it. Vince Vaughn and Kevin James play very best friends, and he sees Kevin James' fiance cheating. Winona Ryder plays her, I think, and he has a dilemma. Do I tell him? Do I not? It reminds me a lot of the James L. Brooks trailer in that it looks common.
Yeah. Well, I did see it, actually, now that you mention it. I didn't even realize it was a Ron Howard movie, and that's what I came away with feeling, is it does not feel like a Ron Howard movie at all. I mean, it feels like old school or something like that. It doesn't seem like something Ron Howard would make at all, which makes me think that maybe the trailer is just a marketing ploy, and hopefully I'm right, and the movie has something more, which is the same thing I would hope for with the James L. Brooks movie, but I agree completely. It just feels so ordinary from the trailer.
Yeah. I just want smart writing from the James L. Brooks movie, like he provides with most other movies he does, so hopefully the writing will save it.
Maybe the writing will. You can't tell necessarily from the trailer, so...
Yeah, I'll wait until the script leaks online. And Kevin Smith, he's making Red State, finally. His long-awaited horror film. It's called a political horror film. Obviously, it's called Red State.
Yeah, I would think with a title like that, yeah.
But you got a cast now. He has a cast. Dermot Mulroney is in it. Melissa Leo. And so is John Goodman, just signed up for it.
Wow.
When you think horror...
I think John Goodman.
And Melissa Leo. My expectations are officially lowered for this movie. I don't know. I guess I've got sort of Kevin Smith whiplash, I guess, completely and officially. I just don't... he's sort of been talking about this movie for what feels like 6 or 7 years now.
Yeah, it's been a while.
And... I seem to remember being excited about it when he first started talking about it, which he's made a couple of movies that I didn't give a shit about since then. So I almost want to see his Hit Somebody movie more than I do Red State. Like, I'd almost rather...
Well, he was supposed to make isn't he making a hockey movie, I thought?
Yeah, isn't that what it's called?
Yeah, Hit Somebody.
Oh, okay, yes, right, okay.
I'd almost rather him go off and make that. Whatever he does, I hope he does something different.
I hope he... Look, he's made good movies. He's made entertaining movies.
Yeah.
You know, I hope he actually directs a good movie. Yeah. You know, I don't know how to say it. I hope he makes a movie that is well directed. Maybe that's
He writes good dialogue. I like him, but he makes a film. This is the thing. He makes a movie, and this even goes for Clerks too, which I hope is the last of those. I think he ended that. Those characters, we've seen enough of that, those characters. I think he ended that. He should never have to go back. And I thought Jay and Silent Bob was supposed to be the end of those characters. But then he made Jersey Girl, and I guess he had to go back to the well. But his movies are good. But if you aren't familiar with the previous movies, those movies are a loss. They cater to his base. They make the same amount,
True. I don't know that that's true, Jerry. Like, everyone keeps talking about how he made the View Askew-niverse movies, the ones with Jay and Silent Bob and, Dante and all those people, and then he goes and makes something like Zack and Miri Make a Porno. Now, that does not take place in the same universe that the Jay and Silent Bob movies do.
Right.
But what's the fucking difference?
Like, no, there is not much of a difference.
You got a movie with a bunch of retards that watch hockey and drink beer, and then another movie with a bunch of retards that watch hockey and drink beer. Like, okay, yeah, they didn't go to the Quick Stop and buy their
same
beer.
Vibe,
what's
though.
Different? Yeah, it's the same vibe. Okay, it's not in the same universe
as
Dante and Clerks, but he needs to do something. It's fine for him to have the same sense of humor. It's fine for him to have the same, dick and ball humor, but he's got to change it up somehow. And Zack and Miri wasn't it, and Cop Out wasn't it. He's got to find
Jersey
some
Girl
way.
Was it?
I don't think Jersey Girl was it.
I agree with his saying. Look, I like Kevin Smith a lot, but even I like Zack and Miri. He tried. What I've always said at first was that Judd Apatow was like Kevin Smith, but with a much more mainstream, wider audience. He didn't leave people
in the dark so much. He crosses over, if you will, to a lot of different groups. Whereas Kevin Smith, you know, you'd be hard pressed to say, yeah, the films are a lot alike. And even a Zach and Marie or a Jersey Girl, as much as they don't take place in that universe, the vibe is still the same.
Exactly.
And I agree with you. Look, I mean, I'm his biggest fan, but I will be the first to tell you, yeah, you know, watching Zach and Marie, it's
well,
like, you know, yeah, I mean, he just took good
right.
after those actors
Jamie.
And made it his movie, though, essentially.
Yeah, he's proven that he's a funny writer. Like,
yeah.
He's proven that time and again. I'm like Jamie, I want him to direct a good movie. You know,
adapt someone else's material.
It's like
right.
musicians, you know, it's... You have, like, pianists. You have your virtuosos. You have your Spielbergs and Finchers and Scorseses. And then Kevin Smith is somebody that just knows how to play a chord.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Not all the keys, you know? And I think that he wanted to make a movie. He thought it would be fun. He made Clerks. And then I think he was faced with the idea of, wow, now I've – what kind of career – now I got to think about career and actually – directing as, you know, as a reality,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
And maybe he survived for a long time on that one note.
But that one
well,
note. Chasing Amy, though,
where,
was the one.
Well, not right. only Chasing Amy, but Dogma also. Like,
sure.
That's where he sort of took a concept and made a good movie out of it that happened to include characters from that universe.
Yeah.
But that's what he needs to sort of do, is take concepts and make a movie out of them. Doesn't matter if it involved that universe or that sort of sense of humor, but he's just sort of focused on a concept. Instead of making Copland and Zach and Mary Make a Porno, maybe Zach and Mary Make a Porno doesn't deserve to be put in the same category as Cop Out.
No, Cop Out is the low.
Yeah, I mean, Zach and Mary has some laughs in it,
mm-hmm.
but it's not.
Cop Out is amply titled.
Yeah, very much so.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They should have gone with their original title, which was a couple of hits with a funnier
yeah.
title.
Yeah.
Okay, Chris, before we go, I want to just say yes or no, or, you know, you can say something a little bit more than that. But we talked about this last show. So, yes, Michael, you did miss Thomas Jane. He is in the first half hour of the show. It'll be available for replay in about 10 minutes. So, Joaquin Phoenix returning to films. It's rumored that his return will be Clint Eastwood's J. Edgar Hoover biopic as Leonardo DiCaprio's lover. Yes or no, good idea?
God, that's quite a one.
Tell me now.
I can't answer that with a yes or a no. Sorry. I just don't know.
His return
about
to films
project.
As an actor, is that a good idea?
Yes, it is. He's a great
it
actor.
Is a good idea.
He's a good actor.
He is.
Very,
great actor.
Very good actor.
I'm happy to see him back. I welcome him back.
Okay, and lastly, Sacha Baron Cohen is Freddie Mercury.
That's an interesting one. I haven't heard about a director or a screenplay for this movie yet. All I heard was that Sacha Baron Cohen was
screenplay is
Mercury.
Peter Morgan.
Ooh, that's interesting. That's really interesting.
Tony Blair?
Sorry, I just had a small stroke. I really want to know about the director, and I also want to know whether or not they're going to use Freddie Mercury's voice or not.
Oh,
because
yeah,
that's
a major
kind of an important. Yeah, it's not quite the same thing as Johnny Cash. Like, a bad Johnny Cash impression or a good Johnny Cash impression will work. A Freddie Mercury impression, first of all, I've never heard one that was even close, and so you really need to use Freddie Mercury's voice, I feel.
It's such a distinctive rock voice, you know, so I think they do need to use his vocals. But
it's
apparently,
sort of like Frank Sinatra.
It's not going to cover AIDS. It's not going to cover his death. It's going to cover a certain period in his career, and so it's rumored that it's probably going to cover the Live Aid period of his career.
Okay.
Mm. No AIDS, but yes on Live Aid.
You know, like Sarah Silverman says, if God gives you AIDS, make lemonades.
good one.
Thank you.
Good idea. He sort of looks like him, but that doesn't really mean much.
Yeah,
he's unproven
yeah.
as an actor. As a true actor, he's unproven. I like Sacha Baron Cohen.
I like
him
too.
Really answer. You can't answer that question because he's unproven as an actor.
Yeah, and he might, but he might be Peter Sellers.
He might be very, very good. Might be very good.
Okay, we got great shows upcoming. Actually, Friday, starting Friday, we'll have a show available Adam Green, the writer-director of Frozen, which, Chris, you got to see that. That's a great movie. I'll let you borrow it. And the new Hatchet 2 will be on with the star of Hatchet 2, Danielle Harris, who you might remember from the Halloween films. That'll be on Friday. I don't even know what's upcoming. Stephen Frears is upcoming, the director. The Grifters, Dangerous Liaisons, and his new movie Tamara Drew, which is really a charming movie. John Curran, the director of the new movie Stone, who also did We Don't Live Here Anymore and The Painted Veil. Martin Landau this month. We got a horror movie series at the end of the month.
Martin Landau.
Oh, no. Here it comes.
Very, very interesting. We're talking about one of, like, if you're talking about, like, top three debates ever on Movie Geek United.
Yep, here it comes.
Even if you're talking, you might even be able to put that into the category for top debate ever on Movie Geek United. It would be a contender. It would be a nominee if there were five.
If you
gotta,
I have enough
you
time with them,
bring
I will
that
ask
question
them.
Up.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
have to bring that question up.
Oh,
if
my
I have
God.
If I have more than 15 minutes, I will ask them about it.
Oh, that's not good enough.
Oh, my God.
I told you, Jamie, I told you.
Hey, dude, I'll take a listener call, and you can play the part of a listener, and you can call, and you can ask them a question, that question.
Oh, I will absolutely do that. Very quickly, for anyone that happens to be listening, very quickly, Jamie and I debate whether or not Martin Landau should have taken a small part in Martin Scorsese's Casino versus taking any other fucking part in the world, specifically the part in BAPS, and whether or not that was a good decision.
Go
to listen to the back episode to hear the argument. But that's
I'm so right in this argument.
No.
I argued that he should have done Casino, and Chris argued the opposite. All right, we'll close the show with a new score from Mao's Last Dancer. Mao's Last Dancer. I'm so sorry. It's a great score. We'll close the show off with it. We'll see you back here. We'll actually be back Friday, but it won't be a live show. It'll be automatically uploaded. We'll be back live on Sunday night. All right, guys. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Good night, everyone.
Good night.